This is the Redeemed Imagination Podcast, a podcast of the Anselm Society. Why did God make us? What do our personal journeys represent in the grand scale of things? Is it really true that things like feasting and creating are acts of war against the enemy that besets us? And what exactly is our place in this world God has made? In this episode, we will explore the hinge question of our ongoing series this year, Why We Create. The question that allows us to begin to explore why and how we should create in God's world. What does it mean to be human? Before we get into that, though, I wanted to draw attention to the fact that on July 21st, tickets are going on sale for our Imagination Redeemed conference, which is September 30th and October 1st, featuring a pre-conference concert by Ella Mine on September 29th. You can sign up on July 21st to get your tickets for that. You can also sign up earlier than that if you're an Anselm Society member. Anselm Society memberships help us pay for things like this podcast and get you discounts at the conference, at other events, as well as to access to exclusive things like bonus podcast episodes. All right, let's jump in to this month's episode as a kickoff essay. Our theme this month is Imago Dei. Being created in the image of God, what does it mean to be a creator created in the image of God? And the person that we went to help us explore this was one of my favorite theologians, Peter Leithart. Peter Leithart is president of the Theopolis Institute, which is doing incredible work recovering what I would term a more artistically informed, certainly a more historically informed way to do church. Peter's also the author of what seems like countless books, including one of my favorites, Miniatures and Morals, the Christian Novels of Jane Austen. But that's neither here nor there. All right, let me read you Peter's contribution to our ongoing Why We Create series. Niggle, the title character of J.R.R. Tolkien's short story Leaf by Niggle, is an ordinary, silly man, a modest painter whose specialty is leaves. He attends to leaves with diligent wonder, spending, quote, a long time on a single leaf, trying to catch its shape and its sheen and the glistening of dewdrops on its edges, end quote. Yet he aspires to more. Beginning from a leaf caught by the wind, he paints a tree. Birds appear, then other trees, then a snow-tipped mountain in the distance. Soon the painting has grown so large he needs a ladder to continue the work. He builds a shed to house the painting, sacrificing a potato patch in the process. The modest leaf painter has become a titanic world artist. Yet Niggle can never bring his painting to a conclusion, in part because his project is too large and ambitious for his skill. Besides, he's fairly good at other tasks, so he's often enlisted to help his neighbors, especially the lame Mr. Parrish. The daily demands of life keep Niggle from his work. Quote, things went wrong in his house. He had to go and serve on a jury in the town. A distant friend fell ill. Mr. Parrish was laid up with lumbago, and visitors kept on coming. End quote. Parrish's wife is feverish. Her husband is too lame to go up and down the stairs. The wind has blown tiles off the roof. The excuses mount and Niggle is called in to help. In his obsession with his painting, Niggle regards those requests for help as interruptions, beneath notice for an elevated tree painter. Niggle neglects his parish in his ambition to capture the world. Tolkien's cautionary tale about the dangers of creative hubris echoes a regular theme of the Christian tradition. Whatever human creativity is, it's radically different from God's creativity. This is what Niggle forgets. God alone creates. It's a variation of the basic axiom of Christian faith. God is God, and you are not. But this crucial truth sometimes leads us to disparage the marvels of human action and creativity. As the Church Fathers said, echoing Plato, God is not envious. He isn't stingy with his gifts. Knowing human nature means not only knowing our difference from God, but also our resemblance to him. To the axiom above, we need to add another. God is God and you're his image. Everything that is, writes Thomas Aquinas, is an effect of the singular cause, which is God. Since effects are like their causes, each and everything in the inner core of its existence resembles the creator who made and loves it. Thomas says there are three degrees of likeness. First, some things are like God simply by existing. Since God is himself being, or esse, every existing thing is like God to some degree. Second, living things are even more like the living God. And third, things that know or understand are most like God, who is intellectual substance. This all might seem a little academic, but it actually has profound ramifications for the way we think about ourselves and our relationship with creation and creating. While all creatures bear some likeness to God, only the last category, rational creatures, have the likeness of an image rather than the likeness of a mere trace. This last category is us. In us, God's likeness becomes an image. Now, a likeness can become an image only when the likeness in question is a specific likeness. A son is an image of his father because the likeness between father and son is a likeness within a species. A son looks like his father. A king's likeness on a coin is also an image because the shape on the coin bears a specific likeness to the model. The human body bears a trace of likeness to God, but in that it's no different from any other created thing. Our intellect, though, has the likeness of an image. For Thomas Aquinas, the image of God is found exclusively in the human mind. The resemblance is very precise. It's not simply the similarity between God thinks and man thinks. To Thomas, divine intellect is triune, and the human mind imitates this triune pattern. Quoting Thomas, "As the uncreated Trinity is distinguished by the procession of the Word from the speaker and of love from both of these, so we may say that in rational creatures, wherein we find a procession of the Word in the intellect and a procession of the love in the will, there exists an image of the uncreated Trinity by a certain representation of the species. As the Father generates a Word and the Father and Son breathe forth the Spirit, who is love, so the human mind forms an inner Word, imagination, intelligence, reason, and so on, and the will impels the human mind to love." This is quite wonderful, but even this is not the whole story. This triadic explanation of the Imago Dei still doesn't quite capture the emphasis we find in the first chapter of Genesis, where the phrase image of God is first used. The Hebrew term for image is commonly used of idols, which visually represent the authority and presence of a god. The creation account is a temple-building narrative, and as the construction comes to its climax, God sets his image within his cosmic house. In forming man, the Creator represents his presence. By placing man in his world, the Creator asserts his authority. Unlike the images of the dead gods of nations, the image of the Creator is an embodied, living soul. Adam's materiality and visibility is, in Genesis, essential to his being the image of God. To be image is to be the visibility of the invisible God. But God doesn't have a body, so how do human beings visibly manifest the Creator? Genesis links the image of God with man's vocation to rule other creatures. Yet to get a full picture of how humans are the image of God, we need to gather clues from the whole creation account. An image of God is like God. To figure out what it means to be made in the likeness of God, we should ask, what is God like? By the time we get to Genesis 1:26, we know a lot about God. First and foremost, God creates. The verb is used 7 times in the first 2 chapters of Genesis. The Creator is a maker. The verb make is used 10 times in Genesis 1, 8 times with reference to things God makes: the firmament, the lights of the heavens, the beasts of the earth and cattle, man. On the Sabbath, God rests from the work which he had made, that is, from all his work which he has made. In case we don't get the point, the author adds, he rested from all his work which God had created and made. As Athanasius observed, God's fruitfulness isn't an addition to God's being. He doesn't become productive when he creates. It's not as if God were eternally barren and then became fruitful. The Father eternally creates. He generates the Son as his living art and image. The Son is not created, Christianity is clear about that, but he is produced by the breath and power of the Spirit as the first and eternal, both past and future, fruit of the God's eternal creativity. Within the life of the Trinity, there is a fecundity of which his work of creation is a manifestation. God is maker, eternally so. If we're made in his likeness, we too are creators and makers. Made in his image, we're made to make. Christians sometimes minimize human creativity. We don't make anything, we say. We just rearrange what's already there. Thomas Aquinas sounds just this note when he says, to create can be the action of God alone. Thomas uses a stipulated definition of create. To create is to be the absolute origin of existence. Thomas wants to protect the uniqueness of God's creative work. Even when we factor in the narrowness of his definition, I suspect Thomas would be profoundly unimpressed with our early 21st century obsession with creatives and creativity. Thomas is essentially right. God says, light please, and there's light where there's never been light before. He says, let the waters teem, and they teem. He says, let us make man, and man is. Only God creates this way. We can't create from nothing simply by speaking. We always use pre-existing raw materials, which we receive as gifts from God. We break them down, mold them, and reassemble them. We don't make animals. We tame them so they provide work and eventually food. We don't make trees. We plant them, cut them down, reshape the wood, and turn it into a shelter. We break and chisel God's stones to make blocks and bricks for temples and palaces. Man is not, as Shakespeare's Coriolanus wished to be, author of himself. Creatures that we aren't even fully authors of the things we author. Yet we shouldn't overstress the contrast between God's making and ours. After all, God himself doesn't make everything ex nihilo. He makes from pre-existing material too. God makes the formless void. He speaks light into existence, and he appears to make other things by pure fiat. Overall, Genesis 1 shows God shaping and filling the dark, watery earth that he creates in Genesis 1. He spends the first half of the week forming the dark and formless void, giving it light and shape. He spends the second half of the week filling the spaces he forms. But he doesn't fill the world directly. He speaks to earth, and earth springs up with plants. He speaks to the seas, and fish teem. He speaks to the land again, and beast, cattle, and creeping things come to life. Empowered by the creating word, the world fills itself. We can draw this rather astonishing conclusion. Creation participates in its own creation. God completes creation by giving creation power to complete itself. With infinite humility, the infinite God creates by giving creatures power to create. God gives unique creative powers to human beings. Enlivened by the breath of God, commissioned by his word, we are created to be creative. As J.R.R. Tolkien often put it, human beings are sub-creators. Despite his reservations about applying create to human making, Thomas comes close to the same conclusion. Because human beings are rational, intelligent beings who are images of God's mind, we are capable of a kind of making that surpasses anything found among animals. And our making images the Trinitarian structure of God's mind. Before I build, say, a birdhouse, my mind generates a plan that is then executed in the outside world. That interior word serves as an exemplar for the thing I make, a likeness to the interior word generated by the Father. I think we must go farther, though. Our creating is like God's in more than this simple analogy. There is a commonality in the process that sparks my imagination. Consider, God uses pre-existing materials to create and make. So do we. God forms and fills, and so do we. God makes new things, and so do we. Of course, we first receive God's gifts, but when we've reassembled them, we've made entirely new things, entirely new categories of things. A table isn't merely a rearrangement of wood. It's a table, a human creation that doesn't exist in nature. It's a created thing God didn't create during the 6 days. When we've learned to spin metals into filaments and to harness electricity and to blow glass, we can make a new thing, an electric light. Every human invention is a little bang, a faint reverberation of God's original fiat. We are creative because God is creative, but more than we realize, we are creative in the same way God is creative. Further, God makes a world he doesn't need. He doesn't dwell in temples made by hands. He isn't served by human hands as if he needed our help. He gives everything life and breath, for in him we live and move and exist. God makes the world out of sheer delight in making, a sheer desire to share his life and glory with creatures. All the way down and all the way in, creation is gratuitous. At the inner core, everything God has made is a gift of grace. In this, our making has a uniquely godlike character. Many things we make with tools aren't necessary for survival. Millstones and ovens are necessary to bake bread, but we don't need bread to keep our biological machine sputtering along. We could, like Jesus' disciples, live on what we rub from ears of grain. We don't need the tools of winemaking because we don't need wine. No animal makes like that, like the transforming of grain to bread, of grapes to wine. No animal has made even so simple a tool as a screwdriver, and all animal tools have a direct relation to the animal's basic need for food, water, and shelter. Animals don't adorn. Birds build nests for shelter and to store eggs, but there are no schools of ornithological architecture. Beavers don't put solariums on their dams, and no bear decorates his den with wall paintings commemorating his hunting exploits. No animal makes for the sake of making. Animals play, but no animal could invent cricket or basketball. Animals do wondrous things, but as Samuel Johnson said, no beast is a cook. On the other hand, human making always verges toward art. Our work aims at glorifying, beautifying, and enhancing creation and human life. Making per se isn't unique to the image of God. Godlike making and gratuitous creativity, these are unique to the image of God. To be the image of God is to be an artist. Artifice isn't an add-on to human nature. It is our nature. Man is like God, so we've asked, what is God like? God creates. He also speaks and creates by speaking. The New Testament reveals the fuller truth. God doesn't just speak, but is word. The speaking God makes man in his own image and likeness, a speaking creature who can talk back to him in prayer, praise, conversation, argument. The God who is word makes human beings by his word in the image of his word. Similarly, we are equipped to make words and sentences and dramas and epic poems, as well as shoes and ships and sealing wax. In this too, humans are images of God. Before his first day is over, Adam is using language. He doesn't begin with Neanderthal grunts. He doesn't point and gesture. He uses words. Adam uses language to take hold of the world and make it his own. His first act of rule is to name the animals. It is a godlike act of calling things by name. Adam fulfills the creation pattern in miniature as observer and participant. God lights, forms, fills, names, so do we. We shape and fill the world and then give names to our creations. In his infinite humility, God receives our naming as his own. God names only a handful of things. The rest he leaves to Adam. Whatever Adam calls something, it bears that name, both for Adam and for God. What does God call a laptop? There's no mystery. He calls it a laptop. What does God call me? He honors my parents by calling me Peter. By naming, Adam classifies, but he also discovers. He learns there is no animal helper suitable to him. Adam represents created features of animals in verbal form. There's something elephant-y about the elephant. The mammoth is truly mammoth. And what else would you call a creature so strange as a platypus? At base, Adam creates names the same way he creates everything else. He makes them up, ex nihilo, as it were. His words don't just mirror the world, they shape it. God's speech is creative, and so is Adam's. The names Adam creates make the world into a human world, made meaningful by human speech. Without Adam's names, the world remains unverbalized, still formless and void. The world is meaningful because it's the product of the word, but we don't merely discover meaning in creation. Meaning is always meaning for someone. The world has meaning for us when we're able to name it. In the image of the divine word, imitating the meaning-giving of the creator, we make creation meaningful. Like the creator, the image, us, creates a world by speaking. Made in the image of God's image, we are image makers, symbolic creatures. We grasp the world through linguistic symbols. When it dawns on Helen Keller that the cool liquid she touches is water, she doesn't just get a name. She gets the thing, The word delivers the world. Linguistic symbols form a shared world. When I tell you that is water, the substance becomes water for both of us. Symbols are more than mere signs or indications of reality. They actually lead to other forms of reality. For example, symbols make human society possible. We commune with one another by communing together in symbols. We say we because we are creatures of symbols, created in the image of the God who said, "Let us." Every society, Augustine says, is knit together by shared signs and sacraments. Because we make and share symbols, we can be more than a pack or a herd. Speaking together, we form one thing, a body. Symbols enable us to share ideas. As symbol makers, we can con-celebrate the Eucharist. Sharing common symbols, we become a human replica of the divine society of Father, Son, and Spirit. By use, word and thing become inseparable. I don't think of the word water as a label pasted on an anonymous liquid. The liquid is water, and we experience it as actually, even naturally, watery. The symbol seems to contain the thing, and the thing seems to embody the symbol, a mutual indwelling that echoes the mutual indwelling of the Father in his image, the speaker and the word he breathes. We inhabit the world we symbolize as our symbols inhabit us. We make ourselves in making our symbols. With all this talk about creativity and the power of the human word, I'm in danger of tripping into a Christianized Prometheanism. To keep my balance, I return to Nigel to see how the ambitions of Tolkien's leaf painter are properly tempered and disciplined. After Nigel catches a fatal cold bicycling in the rain, the driver appears to take him to his final destination. Nigel has to leave his painting behind, uncompleted. Yet he finds redemption in purgatorial therapy at the workhouse. Like the characters in Dante's Purgatory, Nigel is forced to perform the disciplined tasks he's neglected. A negligent gardener in life, he spends ages and ages digging. He ignored Mr. Parrish's broken roof, so he's put to work with saw and hammer and paintbrush. After a life of frenetic, mostly fruitless activity, he's forced to sit in the dark and think. These disciplines chasten and focus Nigel's creative ambitions. A creature's creativity, he learns, doesn't rival the creativity of the creator. In fact, creating out of rivalry, pride, or ambition is precisely the opposite of imaging the creator's creativity. Nigel tried to surpass God by envying God, but God is not envious. On the contrary, the Creator's own creativity is expressed in care, sacrifice, and humility. Genuine human creativity must show the same loving attention to the creation as the Creator. Leaf by Nigel is a meditation on the ethics of time. It's about idleness, the sloth lying behind busyness, the petty selfishness that drives our time-consuming projects, our nearly complete inability to use time wisely. It's also a meditation on time redeemed. On his return from the workhouse, Nigel is astonished to find his tree finished, alive, its leaves opening, its branches growing and bending in the wind. The whole landscape is there, even parts he merely imagined for an instant, strokes that never made it to the canvas. Nigel can only stare in wonder and utter, "It's a gift." So it is. So are all our creations. For we only ever create as a response to a prior word, "Let be." In Nigel's world, Nigel is reconciled with Parrish. All his wasted, mismanaged time is restored. He becomes the creator he aspired to be only after he yielded to the patient rhythms of eternity. In our creativity, as in every other way, we're fully images of God only in the end, when imagination proves true.